Good day. Welcome to the Corey Morgan Show. Spring, it's almost here. I start these with just the weather small talk while you guys get on board and get ready for a bunch of ranting, raving guests and all that good stuff. And yeah, Calgary's covered in snow again. I almost froze to death in yesterday's global warming, but it's supposed to get nice in another week, and we'll have another snowstorm for at least the May long weekend to look forward to. Eventually, though, we're going to be out of winter. I've just never learned to like winter. All right, let's get on to some more stuff. Yes, this is my weekly rant show, and it's live for those who are on live. Anyways, use that comment scroll. I see Doug Jordan, Shauna Vision all saying hello, checking in. Use that. Get those comments in there. Send things my way. I appreciate it. It lets me know you're there, gives me ideas, keeps things flowing. I don't necessarily read them all out. And just stay civil with each other if you're going to have some discourse between each other. I got later in a bit here, going to have retired paramedic Don Sharp on the show. He's been on before, and he's been like a dog with a bone on healthcare reform, particularly when it comes to the paramedical services in Alberta. And it's interesting. It's watching the bureaucracy fighting so hard against Premier Smith and against people like Don to avoid and just stop any productive change from coming. It's a real micro version of what the bigger monster is with healthcare reform that we need to do. And Don's always great to talk to on those subjects. He gets out on the ground and just gets on their case. So let me talk about something that's a little less divisive right now. Let's talk about Quebec separatism. Yes, it's coming up again. It's been in the news. And the independence movement in Quebec, I mean, it's never been gone. It's only been slumbering. And the secessionists within the Bloc Québécois and Parti Québécois, they've just been biding their time and working to create the conditions for a successful independence referendum since 1995. And you look at the other parties within Quebec, whether they're liberal or whatever they might be, ADQ, soft separatists within other parties in Quebec have been doing the same thing. They've been building the conditions for a successful referendum. The separatist movement in Quebec, it's real. And the supporters of it truly want to go. And I know I've talked to lots of people, many in the West, dismiss the movement saying Quebecers don't really want to go. They think Quebec separatists just want to use the threat of secession to squeeze more concessions from Canada. And I'm sure a few are of that sort. And while politicians in Quebec certainly shamelessly use the threat of secession for Quebec's benefit, you're making a really grave error if you think that threat isn't real. I mean, I had the opportunity to meet with some Bloc Québécois members back in the late 90s when I was leading the Alberta Independence Party at that time. And it didn't take long talking to them to realize, no, they really want a fully independent French-speaking nation and nothing less. They don't care about the fiscal costs or the challenges in leaving the Federation. They just want out. Now, the Parti Québécois is poised to win a majority in the next provincial election in Quebec. The third place party in the polls is Québec Solidaire, which is also a separatist party. So, I mean, more than half of Quebecers support one separatist party or another. And Parti Québécois leader Paul St-Pierre Plamondon has now promised another referendum on independence will be held if his party takes power. If there's one thing that the separatists of Quebec learned in 1995 is that they can't pull the trigger on another referendum until they're confident they're going to win it. A referendum loss sets back independence efforts by decades, even if it's on a narrow loss like last time. Some Western independence supporters pushing for a referendum in the West would be well served to keep that in mind, too. So if Plamondon is promising a referendum, it means he's confident that the independent side will win it. After decades of chasing non-French speakers from Quebec through oppressive policies, coupled with antagonizing the rest of Canada to disrupt national unity, Quebec could finally have the winning conditions it sought for an independence referendum. I remember watching the Quebec referendum from afar, of course, as a young Albertan in 1995. Politicians, personalities, and legacy media all worked overtime in begging Quebec not to leave. Delegations crossed the country to wave flags in Quebec and at rallies and let Quebecers know, we didn't want them to go. We love you, Quebec. Stay with us. It was an almost humiliating sort of groveling at the feet of Quebecers. It was successful, though, as Quebecers chose to stay within Canada with a meager 1% margin. Now, as another Quebec referendum is looming, Canada's in a different place. Legacy media, they don't have that stranglehold on information anymore, and Western provinces aren't as solidly federalist as they used to be. The reaction to another referendum in Quebec can and should be much different. The West shouldn't beg Quebec to stay. We should loudly come out and encourage them to leave. We can't hold a referendum to kick Quebec out of Confederation, but we can certainly show enthusiasm for their departure. Canada's broken. It has been for a long time. The Federation slanted in favor of the Laurentian provinces, and even then, Quebec still wants to leave. The Charlottetown and Meech Lake Accords from 30 years ago, they failed to change the Constitution. The only way we can change this system is to tear a province free from it. And Quebec is right now the best poised to do so. If a referendum on independence was to be held in Alberta or Saskatchewan today, The independent side would be lucky to garner 25% support. If the same referendum was held 6 months after Quebec voted to go, though, I think Western provinces would be out the door. Once one province separates, the deal's done. There's little sense in staying within a federation that is no longer figuratively broken, but has become literally broken. Provinces will work to break free and seek their own deals and destinies. This can be a positive evolution for Canada, Quebec, all the West, all of us, and needs to be framed as such. So no, let's not decry Quebec's efforts at independence. Let's celebrate and support them. Quebec is the linchpin. And once it's pulled, Western independence will be soon to follow. So yeah, I'm probably going to mispronounce it, but vive le Québec libre. Don't let the door hit your ass on the way out, guys. That's what I got to say about Quebec and their independence efforts. Go for it, guys. I am behind you this time. Actually, I was kind of behind you last time, too. All right, let's see what else is going on out there. We've got Jen Hodgson checking in from the newsroom, telling us what's dominating the stories today. Hey, Jen, how's it going?
Hey, Corey, doing pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm all right. I smell pizza out there. You guys bring the food in once my show starts. It's kind of cruel.
Oh, yeah, I'll try and save you some for when we finish up here.
Right. So what do we got dominating the news scroll right now?
All right. Well, our top story is the budget that the federal government just introduced yesterday. So Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, her midterm spending deficits are up 95%, with the total spending to be $498 billion. And so there's a number of introductions to this budget, including capital gains taxes are increased to 66.3% for over $250,000. So we see a lot of money being filtered in there. We also see taxes on tobacco, as well as money going towards immigration. So that means hospital care for asylum seekers, for asylum holding places, as well as lodging. So we have a lot of money going into sustaining asylum seekers and refugees. And only about $8 million is going towards managing smuggling of goods that are coming through through our borders. So a lot going on with the budget. We're still going through some of it. And another one that's hot this week is what's going on with the Canadian Security and Intelligence Services. So we have the CSIS director testifying that China is actually an ongoing problem, and CSIS is working relentlessly to deal with Chinese Communist Party infiltration in Canadian institutions. So we saw this through the China inquiry, the Commission on Foreign Interference, where CSIS Director Vigneault testifies that actually he told Prime Minister Justin Trudeau about these warnings, and they had documented evidence that this was going on in the elections from 2021 and 2019. However, the Prime Minister denied that he was ever told this to such an extent that the Commission called the CSIS director back to the stand after the Commission was supposed to be over, who reaffirmed that he did tell Trudeau this. And actually, a lot of this information came out in a late night dump Sunday evening. I think it was the 7th of April, after the CSIS director had already testified. So we've got a lot of murky water going on there. And that's not the only scandal that the Trudeau government is embedded in with CSIS investigating. We also have the Winnipeg Lab scandal. So this comment about relentlessly trying to get in the way of Chinese infiltration in Canadian politics is something that the CSIS director is focusing on. And this came out in the wake of the two Chinese spies that were working for the Winnipeg lab, and they have since been fired about a year. They're fired about a year after it was revealed that they were compromised, actually. So we've got a lot going on with our intelligence agency and our federal government. I'm sure our listeners are familiar with the online harms bill that was proposed in recent months. So we have our Governor General, Mary Simon. She hosted a private symposium for people that are in support of this online harms bill. And it's worth noting that the Governor General of Canada is actually expected to be nonpartisan, and she calls herself apolitical. We have a comment from Rideau Hall insisting that this is the case, even despite the event that she held over the weekend. We also have our federal environment minister, Stephen Guilbeault. He told the House of Commons this week that he's met many farmers from Alberta to Nova Scotia and everywhere in between, Quebec, and farmers are allegedly more worried about climate change than they are about this carbon tax, according to the environment minister, who claimed this in the House of Commons the other day. And to top it all off, we have some more information on the great gold heist that went down at the Toronto International Airport. So it turns out that Air Canada employees have actually been found to be involved in this. We have two present and a former Air Canada employee that has been snagged in relation to this $20 million worth of gold bars, $2.4 million in cash, and about a half mil worth in jewelry.
That's a good haul if you can get it. So, I mean, this budget, I mean, they've been saying it's supposed to be fair for all generations. You know, Trudeau's borrowing so you don't have to. So right. You're of kind of a, you know, a younger vintage than I am. Do you feel confident that this budget is going to serve your future?
Not confident at all. As far as I can see, it's tax upon tax and debt upon debt. So the government is just trying desperately to fill in the holes that it's made with the gross spending and borrowing, more specifically, over the last several years, and trying to patchwork it in by making up for it in tax. So nope, not confident about that. Looking forward to seeing some changes in our federal government very soon.
Well, I guess in the meantime, we can count on you to keep shoring things up. We're going to put things on your credit card, you know, my generation will, and leave you guys to cover it. I mean, we just kicked that can down the road. So get ready for those cuts, I guess, when it's time for them to hit. You know, I think CSIS has been going a little wrong with things as well when it comes to Prime Minister Trudeau. I mean, as you said, your stories keep pointing out and you rate them great. Just has been told over and over and over again about all these things, and he denies it. Maybe he really doesn't remember. But he said before, too, he doesn't read all these things.
He doesn't read it.
They've got to treat it right. Bring him a pop-up book, a coloring book. Prime Minister isn't like other ones. You know, you've got
to make it into a song.
Yeah. On his level. Show the Winnipeg lab and a pop-up book that has a big virus popping out of it. Maybe even then Justin
maybe will, then you would understand the significance of it.
That's right.
he seems quite laissez-faire about these issues, Corey, and that's highly concerning, I think, to a lot of Canadians, just the lack of really interest or any kind of investment into these issues. He's very cavalier about it, as if someone else can do the reading and just give the Cole Notes version. Well, we know what happens to those students in high school that just reads the Cole's Notes versions of the books, right?
Well, we'll do what we can anyways. We can't educate the Prime Minister, but we can educate the public. So thanks for checking in with us today. And
I know you've
got plenty more to write out there. So we'll talk to you after the show.
Yes, it definitely keeps me busy.
Okay.
All right. See you later, Corey.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Reporter Jen Hodgson. That's that time I'd like to remind you, as you can see, yes, she writes a lot of great stories out there all the time. The reason we can do that, guys, is because you've subscribed. This is where I nag. This is where I try to fill the coffers up, but it's important. This is how we stay independent. This is why we are not tax funded. It's through subscribers. So if you haven't subscribed yet, guys, it's $9.99 a month. $100 a year. Come on. Well worth it. Just like a newspaper subscription. And if you've subscribed already, I really appreciate it. You know, it's how we keep these things going, how keep the truth out there. WesternStandard.news/subscription. You can see it at the bottom of the screen. All right. Let's get on to our next guest here. We got in studio Don Sharp. I said he was going to be coming in. It's welcome back, Don.
Good to see you again, Corey.
Yeah. So, I mean, the subject, I appreciate it because, I mean, it's one facet of healthcare. Unfortunately, it's a monstrous animal, a huge bureaucracy, a lot of areas that need to be fixed up. But one that I think a lot of people can relate with, EMS. I mean, it's such an important part of the healthcare services in an emergency situation. It's integrated with the whole system. And if we can't fix that, how on earth are we going to fix the giant monster?
Right. Well, I'm glad to come in and help keep track of progress or lack thereof, or what's actually happening in this one small area of healthcare. You would think that EMS by itself would be easy to fix, but it's so intertwined with the rest of healthcare now, not the way it used to be. So we have some real struggles right now that we're dealing with.
Yeah, well, so we've been talking for a while. We have a more receptive premier than we've had for quite some time. Even Premier Kenny was a bit receptive on some of this. Like, that's what I say with EMS. There's some good common sense solutions. You've been pointing out, others have been pointing out, we're using a lot of ambulances to transport patients that just don't need to be used in that sense when it should be an emergency use. Or they've been draining from rural populations, you know, taking the rural ambulances into the cities and leaving other areas undercovered. Or again, hallway medical care. You know, paramedics have been used to maintain patients. So we know the simple solutions that a lay person can see. Yeah, that doesn't make sense. That's not very good. Yet it's like pulling teeth, getting Alberta Health Services to cooperate with changing some of these.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head. Daniel Smith, I think, understands very well. Our premier understands very well exactly what's wrong with EMS. She came to one of our town hall meetings in Airdrie before she was elected when we were speaking about EMS to the community. And Alberta Health Services has certainly dragged its feet on this transfer issue. It's been more than a year since they put out that RFP looking for contractors. And I'm not quite sure why it took so long. You know, in northern Alberta, north of Red Deer, 90% of patients interhospitally, and many of them by air, are moved by private contracted services. This is not a new phenomenon. And there are private contractors here in southern Alberta. There's Aaron Paramedical, Genesis MediShuttle, MedSource. It does a lot of oil field work. I think it's called LifeLink Ambulance. They do a lot of rodeos and standbys. I mean, all of these qualified private operators that use registered paramedics on their ambulances are willing to step up. And in fact, Aaron Paramedical is moving patients almost weekly, still with a phone call.
Yeah.
Yet they didn't get a shot at the RFP.
Yeah, they put out the RFP, but then they put a whole bunch of roadblocks and you know, the usual bureaucratic crap to make
it. And it was all done in secret.
Yes.
That was part of the frustration. I think for us dealing with Alberta Health Services and EMS now, it's not just the fact that they've failed to fulfill their primary mandate, which is the emergency care and transportation of sick and injured people in the community. They've integrated us into healthcare a lot, including putting us in the hallway. Right. And you just can't survive an ambulance service can't survive when half your fleet's in the hallway. So I think we know what the problems are. And let's talk about this latest contract debacle.
Yes. Well, expand on it. I mean, as you said, the things like even talking to the counties, they've been putting things in camera or trying to get the counties to hold meetings in secret. You've been a thorn in their side because you're attending and you're just exposing what's been said and pressuring.
You know, we've done this before on the show, talking about the number of transfers, non-urgent transfers that are being done from the rural communities using the emergency ambulances, taking an emergency ambulance out of the community for a long time. So this new contract provider in Calgary and Edmonton was supposed to solve those problems, but they're only going to reach 50 kilometers outside of the cities. So if you're in a community outside that radius, this new transfer protocol is not going to help you at all. So what are they doing to satisfy the rural? Well, they've got this new EMS standing committee, which I wasn't qualified to be on and frankly wouldn't sign an NDA to join either. But it'll be another year. They'll meet and then they'll come up with an idea and then it'll take another year to implement it. Meanwhile, today and tomorrow and the next day, non-urgent patients need to be moved for tests and treatment. So You mentioned AHS doing in-camera closed confidential sessions with municipalities. We caught them last week. And kudos to the Foothills County Council, who when AHS showed up and said, we want to hold our meeting with you in camera, in confidence, Foothills County Council said, no. We have a group of citizens outside who deserve some transparency. They've asked that this be a public meeting, and we think they deserve it. So AHS was forced to, and they've held a number of these closed sessions in Claire's home and Nanton. And so we're very concerned with what they're actually talking about and why they want to keep this information from the public.
Yeah, well, and so these non-emergent, you know, transfers, and it's going to be more acute when you get to more rural areas because you have smaller hospitals with limited amounts of specialists. You might have a senior who's in mobility challenge, needs
can't just hop in a car and drive to the city hospital.
Correct.
But at the same time, doesn't need a fully staffed ambulance as well.
It's like taking a limousine to the grocery store.
Yeah.
If you're a non-urgent patient who needs to go for a cast change to get orthotics, to get an MRI because you've got a back problem and you just need a stretcher to lay on, taking the only emergency ambulance for 1,200 square kilometers is foolish. Let's put these reputable, capable, registered paramedics in these private contractors to work. They do a great job. They do it every single day. It's not odd or different or bad. To hear some of the people that object to private enterprise being involved in healthcare, it's shocking how little these people know. They're really quite ignorant.
Well, I wanted to get a bit onto the why. And I mean, the why when it comes to the public a little bit, I think, is because we've had that Canadian training. Just anything private in healthcare, even though they don't realize how much private's already there, but anything private in healthcare is inherently bad. We absolutely must not go down that road. We cannot do that. And they oppose it just on principle immediately. I remember actually a town hall meeting you held down in Okotoks a couple of years ago, and there was a lady going off about that. Oh, we can't have this. I don't care. I just want outcomes. I don't care.
Well, and we want safety, yes, and we want quality. And I think these private contractors in instances like this can give us that. And certainly north of Red Deer, most of the patients are, especially by air. You know how different EMS is in northern Alberta. Most patients, if they're going farther than 250 kilometers, they go by air. And we haven't had any concerns or complaints just because they're private. It's a red herring. And it's a red herring that people who want to keep the government involved and in control for reasons that I don't think are responsible can't defend.
So getting on to that why then, the why is AHS resisting this so much? I mean, they're all evil people. I mean, some of them have got to think, I want to see better services getting.
Well, let me give you a good example. The Calgary zone for AHS EMS now has 70 managers. That means that between Didsbury and Claresholm and Lake Louise and Strathmore, there are 70 people employed by AHS EMS who are executive directors or managers or supervisors or assistants. That's outrageous. And it's my belief, having worked there for a long time, that probably half of them spend their whole day trying to fix problems they themselves created by micromanaging and implementing policies and procedures to mitigate problems like hallway waits, like short staffing, like lack of training. These are most of the problems in EMS these days were created by the people that run it. And there's no transparency and there's no accountability. And that's the frustrating part.
Yeah. And as I said, I mean, it is all tied together and it is part of that big, though Premier Smith is working on breaking up that bureaucracy,
right,
which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's an example of what's going to happen with attempted reforms in pretty much every other department within that giant bureaucracy. I mean, these people shuffling a piece of paper from one desk to another desk and making six figures are not going to welcome change. So if we start the domino falling in one area, though, I think that's important. And maybe they see that too, though.
You know, EMS seems to be the one that would be easiest to fix. Mm. Because if you can just separate them from the hospitals, I really believe that if you don't fix hallway waits, you're not going to fix anything else in EMS. We have to get our trucks out of the hospitals and back on the road. And we're not the answer to hospital wait times. That's a hospital problem. It needs to be managed and fixed by them. So once you separate EMS, fixing it should be pretty straightforward. Focus on the core business of emergency care. Add in the community care. I mean, paramedics are very, we can do a lot. Mm-hmm. Let us go. We'll do a lot. Community care is something we can do, but stop asking us to solve hospital problems. That's not we're not good at it. And we're not able to do it.
It's a different specialty. I mean, it's just as absurd as saying we should then perhaps take the nurses and doctors out to an accident scene to treat them on the spot. That's not their profession either. I mean, they could certainly help and they've got some training, but they don't know how to quickly bundle somebody up, stabilize them and get them to the hospital.
And it's not appropriate. So sometimes paramedics in the hallway will hear from hospital staff, you know, we're all on the same team. And I go, well, I only ever hear that in the hospital. I never see it at 3 a.m. at 40 below on the side of the highway at an overturned car. I don't see anybody from the hospital on my team there. Let us do our job.
They're different professions.
Yeah.
But they're using it as an overlap within the hospitals to make up for other problems. And so when AHS gets broken up, though, is that going to ease some of that? Like EMS is going to kind of fall into a different one of the four.
I think the goal, and I'm not speaking for the UCP or the premier.
No.
I'm I have no axe to grind. I have no interest in that, in being part of that. But I think what is going to happen is if you separate them, you can make them more accountable easier. Mm-hmm. Right now, AHS is a big machine. It's hard to find any. I mean, you talked to some of these managers last week or the week before about who was getting the contract. They'd all say, oh, we don't know. Well, how can you be a senior or an executive director for EMS and really not know what's happening in a week? Like, it's shocking. And the secrecy, the lack of accountability, very frustrating. And that's why we started the Where's My Ambulance campaign.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to that for the final part in chatting with you, because you're getting active. I mean, you're not just pointing out the problems. You're putting pressure on in areas, bringing awareness to this so that they can push for solutions. And, you know, if you can't get it through the bureaucracy of AHS, the municipalities, I mean, they're upset, and getting them engaged, getting them pressuring, or getting the people living in them realizing just how badly served they are, maybe that'll bring some things about. So,
well, I'm not a big fan of raising awareness. I don't like the term. I like getting things done and fixing problems. That's what paramedics are good at. Municipalities, as we've talked before, that's where you start. Your municipal elected officials are there to protect you a lot from other levels of government, especially now. So again, kudos to the Foothills County, who said no to AHS having a confidential closed session. Mm-hmm. And again, there's always conversations that these organizations perhaps need to have, short ones, but to have your whole presentation, your PowerPoint on response times, number of out-of-service ambulances, and especially the Q&A from counselors. You know, we have a group of us, who are retired paramedics and some other knowledgeable citizens, who have offered now to spend some time with counselors who have questions about how the ambulance service runs. Because when these people show up in their uniforms, with their slick presentation, they talk fast, they use a lot of medical jargon, and I think in a lot of cases, counselors aren't sure exactly what questions to ask. And even when we give them questions, they're not sure how to follow up. So if you're a counselor in a municipality in Southern Alberta and you want to have a conversation about what the ambulance service is really doing, feel free to call us.
Well, then for people on the ground, I see you got your sign here.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, I'm just talking of the raising awareness thing.
Yep.
That this is something in a website you've got on the go there. I don't know if we can get that on the camera. That where's my ambulance, and that where'smyambulance.com.
Yep.
It's so nice and simple and to the point.
Yeah.
Where the hell's my ambulance? It's a simple question. It's
and again, one. We go out now to town council meetings and we show up and we ask questions and we encourage citizens in these communities to ask questions. And we showed up again down in High River last week. And we had a group of us stand out front, and a lot of people who stopped, it was funny because they'd look at the sign and they'd go, are you guys here because there's no ambulance in town? People are getting it.
Well, that's what I was talking about with awareness too, though, because a lot of people, I mean, they aren't necessarily paying attention. I live in Prentice, so as we said, our ambulance is getting sniped all the time. It's there. It's rarely there. I mean, it's the default is our ambulance isn't in the bay servicing our area, but your average citizen doesn't know that until they try to call one.
The medics have a special name for the Prentice ambulance, and it's not very polite because it's never there. And that's a tough truck to staff.
Well, because you don't feel like, you know, you joined or you got employed there to work that area, and you find yourself in an urban environment all the time. That's not what you signed up for.
You know, and it's heartbreaking for some of these medics who work in communities like Okotoks and High River, as when they get sent to the city or when they get given a non-urgent transfer, and as they leave town, they see on the map that somebody in their community is having a critical medical emergency, and they're leaving town.
Yeah,
and that's heartbreaking for these medics to work in an organization that seems to not care about the people where they live in their rural communities. It's frustrating.
Well, that's it. And the more populated areas where I live in Prentice area, Hawks Landing, Prentice Greens, throughout that area, all within about 5 minutes of the fire station where the ambulance supposed to be sitting. So, I mean, their question of where's my ambulance comes when they phone and 911 says, it'll be there in 30 minutes. Well,
all the way up to Bragg Creek.
It's right there. No, sorry, that one's in Calgary. They're not going to say as much, but you.
Yeah.
So that's why they should be asking now, not when you're bleeding or when your spouse has had a heart attack or when the issue is going on. We should be asking now because people don't realize it. They might not know it.
And, your ambulance should be in your community most of the time. The only reason it should be leaving is to take somebody to the hospital who needs to go. And it's pretty simple. You know,
it should be.
It should be. And, that's our goal, is to make it simple again.
Well, like I said, I appreciate your work. I mean, your work prior as a paramedic, but now just shining a light on this, because it's one of the areas of healthcare that, as I said, a layperson can kind of understand. I mean, they can't take part in it, but they know, okay, there's an urgent situation. We need to stabilize somebody and get them to care as fast as we can. It's really as basic as that. And yet we can't connect those dots without having to fight a giant bureaucracy. So
it's frustrating. You get it. Yeah.
So I appreciate you coming in to share a bit of that with us today. And again, you got the site wheresmyambulance.com. Is there other areas where people can see what's going on?
Facebook has been a real help. We did a number of town halls in these small communities a couple of years ago. We've started some EMS citizen action groups in these various small towns. Cochran's has been very successful. They hosted a first responder appreciation day on the weekend, and we had over 300 people. I mean, it was just nice to recognize the group. So that group of citizens is doing a great job. If anybody has questions about how to start a citizen action group or become more active in this, we have a lot of service clubs now that are curious too, Lions and Rotary, that want to get involved. So give us a call. Wheresmyambulance.com. Leave us a note, and we'll be happy to respond.
Perfect. Nice and easy to remember. So yes, if you've got questions or you want to get things going in your neighborhood, guys, wheresmyambulance.com. Yeah. Don will fix you up. All right. Well, thanks again. Corey. Good to see you.
Nice to you.
Looking forward to seeing more progress on this.
Right on. I'll give you an update anytime.
Great. Thanks, Don.
Okay.
All right. So again, wheresmyambulance.com. And yes, it's Don Sharp. He's been in before. And he's fun on Twitter and all those social media areas and that as well. I mean, it's just the healthcare monster. And there's areas that I don't understand. You know, I'm gonna make the call out right now. Somebody, please send somebody in. I've had a family member who's been, ailing. I've spent time at the hospital lately visiting, things like that. And I don't understand it. Now, I do understand that the nurses and doctors are harried and they're working very hard and everything, but I also noticed that 90% of their time they're sitting in front of a computer. So what is going on? I honestly don't understand. I don't know. So if somebody can explain to me why it's so integral to deal with the paperwork, with the computer, there's literally every, stand, there's computers all the way through the hallways. There's these stands. We got dozens and dozens of patients. You got a few people moving around, dealing with them, doing what they can, moving them, checking on them, bringing medication, but I see them most of the time staring at a screen. Why? How much? I mean, I understand you have to have a degree of administration and paperwork to deal with a large system in a hospital and things like that. But when they are spending these trained professionals who are supposed to be trained for the care one-on-one with patients, and it looks like they're spending 80% of their time staring at a screen, something isn't working. I mean, going farther back I remember Paul Heyman used to bring that up in his speeches all the time when we were the Alberta Alliance. But, to show some of the bureaucratic problems at the hospitals and things like that, and it's true if you go to them. Go to a hospital Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and try to park. It's just jammed. I don't even start on how much you have to pay for parking, but it's full. It's packed. It's loaded with, you can't get in there. The staff parking's full. Patient parking's full. Go there in the evening. Go there on a weekend. It's empty, aside from a few folks visiting. Well, why? People don't stop being sick on the weekends and evenings. Well, it's because the parking was jammed with bureaucrats. I mean, they still have to be cared for. The ones working the ground, working the wards, they're there all those other shifts. But all the rest disappeared. We've got a load of paper pushers. And when you're having a heart attack, a form isn't going to save you. Somebody typing on a computer isn't going to save you. You need somebody physically with you. You need a doctor later who's going to find out why your ticker is going off on you and hopefully treat that later. But it's hard to do when they're constantly mired in administration. That gets back to, again, this is the nature of government-run businesses, of bureaucracies. Private isn't a solution to everything. We need a mixed system. But I tell you, if there was competition, if there really was, even if it's universal, I'm going to say the blasphemy, yes, we need private care. We need more of it. I want to see private hospitals. I do. I want to see private emergency centers. I want to see them advertising, trying to get you to choose them as the place to go to, even if you're not paying out of pocket. There's ways we can deal with this. And I tell you what, it'll get better a lot faster. Down in the States when I was working down there, I remember in Hobbs, New Mexico, driving on the highway, there was a billboard for a hospital and it had a digital readout actually showing what the emergency wait times were. It would say, come to our hospital if you need to, because they're competing. And the emergency wait times are on average, and it tended to be 10 minutes. I think the longest I ever saw was 40 minutes.
Now, we're in Canada. How are we doing? It's free to die on a gurney because you're waiting 23, 48 hours. I mean, the numbers are obscene what you have to wait for emergency service now in Canadian hospitals. So set aside that instinctive opposition to private involvement. Let's look at outcomes, guys. We got to make it better. And if you were running a private facility and you're walking up and down and your professionals are mostly sitting in front of computers all the time, you're not going to get patients coming back because they're realizing they're not getting the best service they can. And as an operator, you're going to change things. Is it the person sitting in front of the computer is not doing a good job? Or is it your management that's putting too many administrative tasks on the professionals who should be working on the ground? I don't know. But these sorts of things can be solved. But when you're in a giant monolithic bureaucratic system, there's only one system, there's no incentive to fix that. There's no motivation to change it. And again, it keeps coming down to throwing more money at it. We've been throwing money at it. Canada is one of the highest spending countries in the world when it comes to healthcare spending. And it's not getting us better outcomes. I mean, it's just not cutting it, guys. I mean, one of the areas too, some of the blasphemy. Guess what, guys? Nurses aren't saints. I get sick of that. I get sick of the nurses' union. Not the nurses themselves, but their bloody union. And they support that union, though, a lot of them. And look up, if you want to look up a story, look in Alberta, and I'm sure it's the same in every province. The sunshine list, is it what they call it or whatever? The ones who get over $100,000 a year, and there are a lot. There was one in Alberta, I believe that nurse got over $400,000 because they play an interesting game. Most of them are part-time, but they work full-time hours. You see, the way it works is they automatically get overtime the second they work a shift that wasn't scheduled for them. And they play a really neat game. So you put yourself down as part-time, but then you sign up for all the other shifts that come along. And even though you're only working 40 hours a week, you can end up having half your hours being overtime. And nurses' overtime isn't like our overtime with its time and a half. They get 2.5 times. And then if you work on a holiday, oh, they can get up to quadruple time. And you work in the evenings, you get an evening premium. And you work on the weekends, you get a weekend premium. And you can work as a part-time nurse and end up pulling in well into over $100,000 a year. It's ridiculous. If you're going to work over 40 hours a week every week, change it. Make them full-time. Make them like real people in the real world. If you're working overtime, you're getting overtime fine after 44 hours, like the rest of us, or even 40. But no, they game the system. And I tell you, the unions get worked up every time that's brought up. That's one of their little secrets they love going on about. You know, they're gaming the system. Look, nurses are professionals. They work very bloody hard. I understand that. But if they're screwing us, I can only support so far. Competition. A private operator is not going to put up with that crap. They will pay a high price for good professionals in their institution, but they're not going to put up with them gaming them on it, are they? Yes, we need to change this. Either way, one of the first steps, which I think was great, is Premier Smith is breaking up the AHS, the Alberta Health Services for people who are outside of Alberta, into separate units. So there's going to be 3 or 4, I believe. That way it's not such a giant monster. You know, she's biting it apart a little to fix it up. And as Dawn was talking about, we can look at little areas of it, such as EMS. We can fix that and we can show that there can be improvements on some of these things because it's ridiculous right now. Speaking of ridiculous, this is one of the things that Jen mentioned earlier. So, you know, let's just go into some federal stuff. The Governor General, yeah, she's had online harm symposium she's hosting. And this was for Bill C-63. She basically came out in favor of a Liberal government bill. Now, people who aren't political wieners like myself might not really understand just how egregious this is, just how bad this is. This is the King's representative taking a stance on political policy, becoming political, becoming partisan. She's supposed to be nothing more than a rubber stamp. I know people talk about the office of it and should be respected. No, they don't garner my respect anymore. They're a remnant of the feudal system. At least just be the ribbon cutter you are, the celebrity you are, the patronage appointment you are, the token you are. Because that's what she is. And just do what you're told. Take your six-figure income. Take your servants. Take your flights. Don't dip into the policy realm. And she did that. That's a huge line crossed. Huge. That would be the same as King Charles getting in, or Queen Elizabeth in the past, and actually starting to
take part in the policies happening in Parliament. You do not do that. Queen Elizabeth never did that. She knew better. And King Charles doesn't seem like the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he's been well enough trained. He knows better, too. Doesn't mean they can never speak to a policy, but you don't get right in on bills and talk about how you should support one or not another. This was a big line crossed. We've had nothing but crappy governor generals for a while now. Trudeau's really picking winners. And this line, you know, it's not making enough news. It's gotten overshadowed, unfortunately, by the budget. But she's a terrible governor general. Terrible. But she checks off the boxes that Justin wanted, and that's why she's in there. I'm going to say it as it is, because that's the case. And it's got to stop. And that budget is a brute. So how are they going to pay for all of this spending, this massive spending, right? Capital gains taxes. Capital gains taxes are economic killers, guys. Economic killers. You want to drive investment and innovation and enterprise out of your nation, there's no better way than a capital gains tax. And increasing it is only going to make it worse. They think they're going to screw a $20 billion over the next few years out of people by raising that capital gains tax. It's not going to work because people move their money. Capital moves. They will take it elsewhere. They won't get the money they think they're going to get. Plus, they're going to harm the economy because when these investments, these enterprises pull out of Canada, they lay people off. We have less services. We have fewer people working. And the cycle just continues. Oh, it's just taxing the rich. No, it's not. Oh, the corporations will pay. Yeah, think about that. Think about that a minute. Corporations. Ooh, corporations. They're all evil. They're all nasty, right? My bar was a corporation when I owned it. Pub. Not a billion-dollar enterprise, but it was incorporated. It technically was a corporation. If it had gained over a certain amount of value over the years of slaving and toiling and working and building the business, and if I'd sold it for a certain amount over what I bought it for, I'll be punished for that? Yes, actually, that's what a capital gains tax is. And it's not all big business, guys. Your local doctor is probably incorporated with his clinic. He's going to be thinking, maybe I'll just move my clinic south of the border, or I'll go to Europe, or I'll go to Vietnam. Why do I want to sit here and get punished for success? Because that's what capital gains taxes do. They punish the successful. So they keep talking about, oh, it's just on this ultra rich. No, it's not, guys. It's on every corporation in Canada. And then the big corporations anyways. Corporate profit. Oh, people spit that out. Profit. How evil. Dingbats who don't understand how pensions work talk about how bad corporate profit is. If you don't want your pension to grow, okay, then maybe you are opposed to corporate profit. Do you think it grows like a freaking daisy just on its own? No. That pension fund is invested, and guess what it's invested in? Corporations. And if that corporation doesn't profit, your pension doesn't grow. You are a corporate shareholder, even if you don't realize it. You are a beneficiary of those profits. And those profits get taxed. So don't go down the idiotic liberal, now NDP socialist rabbit hole of constantly demonizing corporations, businesses, people who are productive, people who are building an asset, because it hurts all of you, even if you don't realize it. It does, because that's the game the liberals are playing. They segregate who they're going to hit with the extra taxes, and people think, oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't hit me. It is hitting you, even if you don't see the path of how it does. Our economy is in serious, serious trouble. People's eyes glaze over when we talk about it, but it's important. I keep bringing it up. Look at it. The GDP per capita ratio in the United States, GDP per capita is over $70,000 American. In Canada, it's $54,000 American. Think about that. Look at the size of that gap. Almost $20,000 American dollars. You have less of the pie. That's how much less you have than our Americans south of the border. And they have cheaper food. They have cheaper housing. Their cost of cheaper gasoline. Everything's cheaper down there. And they have more money. Guys, we're up the creek. And why is it like that down there? Because their economy is doing great. Meanwhile, we're kicking our economy in the balls. Trudeau is going after business owners. He's going after the corporations. He's going after the productive people. That's just going to cycle our per capita GDP share even lower, guys, while he digs us deeper and deeper in debt. And that dingbat is going to be on a tropical island someplace, retired with his trust fund, while the next generation pays the friggin' bill. And it's just odious and it's repugnant. And while he sits up there prancing around as he did yesterday, oh, this is fairness for all generations. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's screwing the current generation and is robbing the next one. And this budget will pass. You know, Jagmeet Singh, biggest pussy in Parliament, he's doing his tough talk. Oh, I don't know if we're going to support the budget. Of course you're going to support the budget, you clown. You're Trudeau's little puppy dog. God, it's going to be embarrassing being an NDP member these days. It really does. When your leader is such a dish rag. Seriously. Just don't pretend, Jagmeet. You're going to support the budget. Of course you are. You don't have the money or the brains to fight another election. You know, this is as close to power as you're ever going to get. So no, it's not going to happen. Yeah, so I see the commenter Bruce Leslie saying, yeah, it's amazing how few people understand how the pension plan is invested. I know. It's sad and it's frightening. And if people think they're doing the world a favor when they attack businesses, they aren't, guys. You're dependent on them. They're important to you, even if you don't realize it. Either way, that's all the time I got for today. We're going to have a lot to talk about on the pipeline a little later, so be sure to tune in for that, guys. And again, take out a subscription if you haven't already. There's lots on the go, lots to cover, lots to talk about. So yeah, tune into the pipeline tonight. Get to the westernstandard.news to catch all of this stuff directly, guys. And we will see you all again next week at this time. I'll have a whole bunch of new stuff to complain about.